Welcome to Bicom's podcast. My name is James Serene, Bicom CEO. I am delighted to be joined by Anshul Pfeffer. Anshul, thank you very much for joining me.
Good evening, James.
Anshul is the biographer of Bibi Netanyahu. He wrote The Turbulent Life and Times of Bibi Netanyahu. He's a writer for Haaretz, correspondent for The Times, for The Economist. He writes for The Jewish Chronicle. So there is still room for him to write for some other publications, if anyone out there is listening and wants to hire him. We are doing a special podcast this evening. We are walking through central Tel Aviv because we are in a packed series of meetings and events in a very busy week in Israel. The Trump plan for Israel and the Palestinians has just been published. Bibi Netanyahu is in Washington. I believe he's going to Moscow. And so it's vital that I get a chance to talk to Anshul and get his take on what he thinks about the US plan and where that positions Bibi Netanyahu politically in the election. Anshul, if I could just get your first thoughts on what you thought of the plan.
I mean, I think the plan was actually in many ways better written and more detailed than a lot of us expected it to be. And we've been waiting for 3 years for this plan, and we've had it's had different names. It's been called a vision by Jared Kushner. Donald Trump called it the other day a suggestion. So you know, we've been quite skeptical about the level of detail, and even though they've been working on it for years, there's been this sort of skepticism, as I can say, about the plan.
So you were surprised at how serious and detailed it was?
It was quite serious and well thought out in some aspects, and we're still reading it, as we speak. I mean, I've just been texting with various colleagues of mine. Everyone's looking at different chapters and finding interesting details. And some bits of it are quite original. Some bits of it are less. You know, it's the kind of thing we've been hearing for many years. That both Trump and Netanyahu in the presentation of the White House, they both came with a set narrative. Now, Bibi Netanyahu's been thinking and talking and writing about these issues for his entire career now, for over 40 years, while Trump is, we wouldn't really call him a Middle East expert. So Trump's speech was obviously written for him by his team. But there's a very interesting narrative there. And both men mentioned what happened in 1948 when the UN had its partition plan for two states, a Jewish and an Arab state. And the Arab side, then nobody called them the Palestinians then, but what we would call today the Palestinians, rejected it, and there was a war, and et cetera. And everyone knows the history. But there was a narrative there at work saying, look, the Palestinians missed their chance now. Now Trump is presenting it as another opportunity, and he actually used the words last chance. Mm. And I found that very interesting. I think there was a bit of a threat there to the Palestinians as well. And we know the Palestinians have already rejected the plan even before seeing it. They haven't been engaging with the administration for over 2 years now, ever since Trump announced that he's recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. So I think there's more, I mean, some may say it's a conspiracy theory, but I think that at least for some of the people involved in preparing the plan, and for Netanyahu himself, there's an expectation the Palestinians will turn it down, and they're already thinking of the day after and what to make of that rejection.
Did you think that the way that they designed those conditions in terms of on the Palestinians, that Hamas needs to disarm, Islamic Jihad, there has to be human rights, end of payments to Palestinians convicted of terrorist offences and people killed carrying out attacks, end to incitement to violence. These are all sort of conditions designed for the Palestinians to basically just reject it outright. I mean, they're going to do that anyway, but did you think that it was something that was designed to be rejected?
I think it was very clear that that as far as the Palestinians are concerned, it's a non-starter. Is that what Trump really thinks? I think Trump actually does see himself as the master deal maker and would be very satisfied if the Palestinians were to come and say, you know what, we accept this, or we'll accept this as a basis for negotiations and as a framework which we can use going forward. I think Trump himself would be happy if that was the case, but I think some of his advisors, and certainly Netanyahu, or banking on Palestinian rejection, already planning what to do with that.
It's, I mean, looking at some of the proposals, I mean, You know, as regards, for instance, Jerusalem, Palestinians can have a capital, but, you know, outside of the kind of security barriers, so not quite in those East Jerusalem neighbourhoods, certainly quite far from the old city. You know, complete Israeli control over the Jordan Valley, you know, forever. And also a lot of, if not all, Israeli settlements staying within Israel. I mean, that looks like a plan that's very much in Israel's comfort zone. But I think the interesting thing that most people wouldn't really be picking up is that actually, it's quite uncomfortable for Netanyahu because, you know, I think some of the secular leaders have already said that they're very unhappy about the plan. How do you see that?
I agree. If the plan were to be implemented, it would be uncomfortable for Netanyahu because there is a Palestinian state in that plan, even though it's a truncated state. They call it contiguous, but it's almost a series of enclaves and obviously demilitarized and without control of its airspace, etc. So it's not a regular state in any accepted understanding of what a state is. But even that, I think, is something that Netanyahu doesn't want, and certainly not the Esher Council and the settlers and the leaders of the Esher Council who were in Washington today and were already saying this is something that we aren't going to agree with. So it is outside his comfort zone. But once again, the question is, is Netanyahu really looking at this plan as something which would ever be implemented, or is he simply paying it lip service for Donald Trump's benefit? And Netanyahu is doing two things with this plan. One thing is the short term. This is his main plank of his campaign in the next 5 weeks. We've got an election on March 2nd. Netanyahu desperately needs to move the agenda away from his own legal issues, and on the same day that the Trump plan was presented, Netanyahu has been indicted. Formally indicted, the first serving prime minister in Israel to be indicted ever. So he needs to move the conversation onwards. And Trump has given him, with this plan, this wonderful gift of a talking point. And this is a massive, beautiful, shining talking point which he will make full use of over the next 5 weeks. The next thing he'll do is, if Netanyahu wins the election, if he somehow manages to evade or somehow remain prime minister while on trial, then this plan will be something he'll use to present the Palestinians as rejectionists, and that he could use to make the point that he's always tried to make throughout his career, that the Palestinian claim for statehood is not a real national aspiration. It's a way of stronger, darker forces to try and undermine Israel's very existence.
So he didn't mention a Palestinian state at all.
Which was very interesting, because Trump rhapsodized the Palestinian state about how much a wonderful independence state it could be if only the Palestinians went along with his plan. Netanyahu didn't mention, he talked about negotiating with the Palestinians, he talked about the future for the Palestinians. He didn't use the word state even once, and that's no coincidence. He knows that his coalition includes parties and lobbies and groups and individuals who are very much against any sort of Palestinian state, and therefore he won't bring up those words.
And he talked about, certainly inferred about applying Israeli sovereignty to settlements, to the Jordan Valley.
Oh, he didn't infer, he said it very clearly.
He said it clearly, didn't he, in his speech, and his spokesman afterwards confirmed it. And, I mean, I wonder if we could just think about whether that actually is going to have any impact. I mean, he's promised that he's going to do that. He promised he'd apply Israeli sovereignty to all settlements before the April election. He then added applying sovereignty to the Jordan Valley for the September election. He did nothing in between to move that forward.
And he's done nothing in the 13 years he's been Prime Minister.
So do you see that as something real? And if it isn't real and it's just a promise, why does he keep promising it? Because it hasn't won him any votes.
That's a really good question. Does Netanyahu believe this is still a winning campaign ploy? And obviously he does, because, like you say, he's been using it now three times. Netanyahu's strategy for this election is not to broaden the appeal of Likud towards the centre. It's to try and eke out as much of the right-wing base as he can. He believes that there are hundreds of thousands of right-wingers, of Likudniks, who stayed at home in the last election and in the last two elections, and that this, he just needs the right motivation to bring out the vote. In 2015, he used the racism issue. He used all the incitement against Israeli Arabs. The famous Arabs are voting in droves, and text messages claimed that Arabs would, that Isaac Herzog, who was the leader of Labour, had promised all kinds of things to Israeli Arabs, and so on and so forth. That seemed to have worked in 2015, because in the last few hours of the voting, Likudniks came out, and we saw also the differences in the exit polls, because the exit polls were prepared by 8 p.m. Yeah. The real polls closed at 10 p.m. We saw discrepancies of Likud turnout in the last 2 hours of voting in 2015. So Netanyahu still believes that he can somehow tap into that reservoir of stay-at-home Likudniks, and he just needs to find the thing to motivate them. And as far as he sees it, this is it. This is the Trump plan is what will bring them out and will somehow rejuvenate Likud and make it once again the largest party and give him the majority he needs to form an elect, to form a government, and somehow to change the laws and get him immunity from prosecution.
But if those right-wing parties, particularly like Yamina, Naftali Bennett, and she's seen as a very pro-settlement party, if they come out and say this is a terrible plan, and we oppose it, then hasn't he failed?
No, because he's actually because it's what Netanyahu says to them in private, yeah. And it's what Netanyahu says in public. In public, he can't be seen as anything but 100% to be endorsing the Trump plan. In private, I'm assuming, and from what I'm hearing, he is saying to them, look, be patient, this is never going to happen, play along with me, I haven't failed you in the past, don't rock the boat. Now, they have to be saying these things as well, because they have to be differentiating themselves from Likud. If you're a right-winger, why not vote Likud? Bennett says, we're the ones who are openly against the Palestinian state, we're the ones who are preventing Netanyahu from being weak on this specific issue. So it's actually worked well for everyone. Nobody said, we're going to leave Netanyahu's coalition. They said, we won't allow this to happen. And Netanyahu said, in public, I'm endorsing the Trump plan, but he's not using the words Palestinian state, which allows him to say in private, don't worry, it's not going to happen. And we've seen in the past various recordings of Netanyahu saying these kind of things on previous American plans. There's a famous recording from him after the first time he lost an election from the early 2000s, where he visits a family of settlers and he says to them, I worked very hard to stop the Clinton administration's plans and to carry on Oslo. And I'm sure he's saying the same kind of thing behind closed doors today to the settler leaders.
In terms of some of the detail of what happens next, I mean, there's already been an announcement that he's going to get the Israeli cabinet to approve applying Israeli sovereignty to settlements in the Jordan Valley. What does that actually mean? So if the cabinet agrees that, what needs to happen next to be implemented?
On the ground, it won't have a real change in the way people live, because Israelis living in the Jordan Valley or in any other settlement in the West Bank already live according to Israeli law. So Israeli law applies to them wherever they live in the West Bank, even though the law doesn't apply to territory. And the blueprint for the annexations is only to annex places where Israelis live, not to annex anywhere where Palestinians live. So this may not actually have a real effect on the ground.
But in terms of trying to actually do it and make it happen, so the cabinet will decide it, but that doesn't make it happen.
No, it doesn't make it happen. There are lots of legal mechanisms which have to be used.
Yeah. Does it have to pass the Knesset?
And we don't know for sure. Right. I mean, this is something that in the past has been voted. So we have two previous episodes where Israel did annex or extend sovereignty to parts of the territories which were captured in 67. We have East Jerusalem by the Eshkol government shortly after the Six-Day War in 1967. We have Menachem Begin in 1980 doing it with the Golan Heights, and in both cases these were acts of Knesset. But the legal opinion on whether it has to be a vote in the Knesset is unclear. What we do know is that Netanyahu will bring it to the Knesset because he wants to use this to try and embarrass Blue and White and show them up as being not loyal enough and not being unpatriotic in not grasping this wonderful
opportunity. So So just one last question on Benny Gantz and how you think he's played this particular episode and how his trip to Washington went.
Look, Gantz on Thursday night, when Mike Pence, who was here for the Holocaust Forum summit, announced that Netanyahu and Gantz will be coming on Tuesday to Washington for the unveiling of the plan, Gantz realized he was in a trap, because at the end of the day, Netanyahu is the prime minister. He's not. So Netanyahu would be the one on the stage, and Gantz would have some very minor supporting role. And that's exactly what Netanyahu wanted. He wanted to diminish Gantz's stature by putting him in this sort of second fiddle, afterthought position, and also perhaps to create a situation where Gantz afterwards would find it difficult to say no to a national unity government under Netanyahu after the next session, as he did in the previous months. So Gantz realized it was a trap, and over the weekend his people made it clear to the White House that he would not be arriving on Tuesday, because A, there was supposed to be the vote on immunity, and B, he demanded his own personal meeting with Donald Trump. And interestingly, Donald Trump both he said yes, and he also didn't inform Netanyahu. So Netanyahu wasn't informed. Netanyahu's right-hand man, who also happens to be Israel's ambassador in Washington, Ron Dermer, wasn't informed. They're both kept out of the loop, and they only learned about it very shortly before Gantz's announcement on Saturday night that he would be going to Washington on Monday for this meeting. I think Gantz played that very well. However, at the end of the day, after all we've seen today in Washington with that grand show of Netanyahu and Trump together, look what Netanyahu has done very well for himself this week. Gantz could have been in a worse situation, and he did okay by getting this meeting. And even we saw Trump at the beginning of the press conference saying, yeah, I met with the
general,
with Netanyahu, and with that other man who was trying very hard to be the next prime minister in the longest election campaign in history.
And he called him the general, which was quite,
I think he showed a lot of respect to Gantz. It was certainly good for Gantz. Also, it strengthens the theory that Trump may be calling on Netanyahu. Netanyahu failed to win two elections in 2019. Trump no longer sees him as a winner. At the same time, a lot of people around Trump, and certainly in the evangelical base of supporters that Trump is building on for his re-election, there still is a huge admiration for Netanyahu. At the same time, he's working closely with Netanyahu. But I think he gave Benny Gantz, leader of opposition with no formal position, the kind of respect that you would rarely see a president of the United States give to any leader opposition of another country.
So a win.
So a small win for Gantz. He certainly handled himself very well. He even stage produced a lovely little moment before his meeting on Monday, where all the Israeli media suddenly, by coincidence, captured him having a jog around the White House. That was a great frame for him. So it was a good week for Gantz, but it was a much better week for Netanyahu. Netanyahu now has this massive event, this Trump plan, with which he can try and dominate the agenda of the next few weeks. And if it works for him, try and shut out as much as possible the media, the headlines, and
about
any
coverage.
Kind of coverage. It's not going to work 100%. There'll still be a lot of coverage of that, but he can now stage manage so many events. He can go to the West Bank to develop places and say, this is a place which I'm annexing. Yeah. He'll pass a cabinet decision on Sunday, then he'll bring it to the Knesset. So he can now dictate the agenda to a degree which a few days ago we thought he already couldn't. And at the same time, he is now at the mercy of the courts, because the moment he announced that he's withdrawing his immunity request, The charges were filed at the district court in Jerusalem. So that is a whole process which he has no control over, and he'll have to answer to the charge sheet. And who knows, maybe they'll schedule already a session before the election, though it's not easy to schedule that kind of a case so quickly. It's also because as Prime Minister, he'll have three judges, so to get three judges together on time may not be so simple, but he no longer controls
that
his
agenda.
Fate.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Well, Anshul, thank you so much for joining us and for that lovely walk around Tel Aviv.
Always a pleasure.